Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, Pardes alum. This week, Vayeshev. This week, Rabbanit Nechama Goldman Barash discusses Vayeshev. This podcast is sponsored by Marsha Weitzman in honor of her granddaughters Rachel and Shira Sachs on the anniversary of their Benot Mitzvah, Vayeshev, and on their birthday. Thanks very much for sponsoring the podcast. If you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact our office via info@pardes.org. This week, Vayeshev with Rabbanit Nechama Goldman Barash. Rabbanit Barash is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbanit Barash.
The Parsha is Vayeshev, and we're going to study chapter 38 in Genesis, the story of Yehudah and Tamar together. I'll just remind the listeners that this story is situated between the sale of Joseph by his brothers and the arrival of Joseph in Egypt. So this narrative really serves as a break in the Joseph story in order to take a look at what happens to one of the brothers, Judah, who emerges later as a leader of the family and a leader of the tribes, what happens to him in this interim period between the sale and, of course, the many years later when there's a reunion with Joseph. So we have a story, and the text already tells us with one word how it feels about the journey the brothers take in the wake of the sale of Joseph, that it was at that time that Yehuda went down, Vayered Yehuda. If we open up chapter 39, we find out that Yosef hurad Mitzrayma, that Yosef is taken down, Joseph is taken down to Egypt involuntarily. And here we have a voluntary going down. Yehuda separates himself in the wake of the sale from his brothers. And as we'll see in the chapter, there's a spiraling downward in Yehuda's behavior that is a consequence of the sale of Joseph. And the text allows us to understand that by using this word vayered, which connects us to chapter 39, vuhurad, that Joseph is forced out of the family camp. He is forcibly taken down to Egypt, and that corresponds with Yehuda choosing to leave the family camp in response to that forced eviction of Joseph. Vayet ad ish adulami ushmo Chira. And so he camps near a certain Adulamite whose name was Chira. And so now we find out that Yehuda, who has not yet begun to build his own family, sees the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua, and he takes her and he comes in unto her. And so the daughter is not named. We never know the name of his wife. All we know is the name of her father. In biblical times, of course, the father would have been the one to negotiate the bride price and engineer the marriage. But it's as if the daughter and her identity are almost irrelevant or are irrelevant to the story. I will point out that in previous chapters of Genesis, marrying among the Canaanites was considered to be a negative thing. Meaning Abraham sends his servant to Padan Aram to find a wife for Isaac so that he not marry among the Canaanites. Esav, who takes two Canaanite women, does so at the displeasure of his parents Isaac and Rebekah. And here we have Judah, who when he leaves the family camp, disconnects and disengages to the extent that one of the first things he does is marry a Canaanite, something that certainly will cause displeasure to his father. What happens next? Vatar v'teled ben. So, you know, the right thing, things happen in the right order. She becomes pregnant. She has a son to carry on the family name. V'yikrat shmo er. And we find out that Yehuda names him Er. Vatar od v'teled ben v'tikrat shmo Onan. She has another child, another son, and she names him Onan. V'tosef od v'teled ben v'tikrat shmo Shelah. She bears another son and names him Shelah. V'ayah b'chsiv b'lidata oto. And we find out he wasn't even home for the birth of the third child. He was at Ksiv when she bore him. In other words, on one hand, she gives birth and he names the child. On the third time, though, at this point, Yehuda has already distanced himself even from this family unit. By the time she has the third child, it suggests she names the child because Yehuda isn't even around. He's at Kziv. V'yikach Yehuda isha le'er b'chora. And now Yehuda does what perhaps Yaakov should have done for Yehuda but didn't do. He marries off his son, Er. It's time for Er to get married, his firstborn. Ushma Tamar. And he married her to a woman named Tamar. And of course, as we're reading the story, we can't help but notice that Yehuda's wife has no name, but his daughter-in-law, Tamar, does have a name. So as readers, we're prepared to understand that Tamar is going to play a central role in this narrative. So we find out that Er, Yehuda's firstborn, was evil in the eyes of God. And God takes his life. God causes him to die. So we already know something that we're going to find out Yehuda does not know, or perhaps does not want to know. But that is, Er's behavior is so displeasing to the Lord that God causes his death. Vayomer Yehuda lo Onan, bo el eshet achicha v'yabemota v'hakem zera l'achicha. And the first thing Yehuda does is say to Onan, in the wake of this tragedy, join with your brother's wife and do your duty by her as a brother-in-law and provide offspring for your brother. Now I will say that, of course, this story can be read in so many ways and there's so much to do with narratives in Tanakh and particularly in the book of Bereishit. But what we have here, I would suggest, is Yehuda in the grip of mourning the death of his bechor. We've already been told Er is his bechoro more than once, and or we'll continue to be told that Er is the bechor. And what he wants to do is preserve the bechora. He wants to Onan to have a child that would continue the lineage of Er. We, of course, know that that's impossible. Once Er dies, there's no way to perpetuate his lineage. He's dead. But Yehuda, perhaps grasping at straws in the wake of his grief, insists that Onan take Tamar and have a child for the dead brother. Now, later on in Devarim, in Deuteronomy, we're going to call that yibum, or leveret marriage. It's going to be a very particular mitzvah, particular command, that the brother of the dead brother take the widow, exactly as Yehuda is asking Onan to do, in order to build up the home or the name of the deceased. And so what we see here is an early description of what later will become a mitzvah. I will say that scholars who have studied the ancient Near East do not find an exact parallel to yibum, to leveret marriage. What they do find is the widow would stay within the clan or within the tribe and perhaps marry a cousin, an uncle, but not necessarily or specifically a brother. So this seems to be unique to the biblical narrative, as far as I can tell. Now, one has to ask, what is Onan thinking? What is Tamar thinking? Well, we don't usually ask women what they're thinking, but Onan, as we're going to see from his response in the next verse, is not going to be happy about this. And if I use a modern psychological lens, the idea of one brother stepping into the shoes of another brother is very complicated. And I'll say even further, in the book of Bereishit, even without modern psychology, the idea of the second brother stepping into the shoes of the first brother in order to have a child to replace the first brother, but essentially leave the second brother out in the cold, is almost unthinkable. We have sibling rivalry from the very beginning of brotherhood with Cain and Hevel, and then with Yitzchak and Yishmael, and with Yaakov and Esav. And the idea of Yehuda asking Onan to do this for Er is not a simple request. V'yeda Onan ki lo yehazara. And in fact, the Torah even tells us, Onan understands that his seed will not be his own. In other words, he'll be impregnating this woman in order to bear a child that won't be called after him, but after his dead brother. And we find out that the verse is actually quite violent. It says he spills his seed. He lets it go to waste. And shichet, I think, is an even stronger word than that. He destroys, he knowingly, willingly destroys his seed so that it not provide offspring for his brother. In other words, Onan reacts very viscerally, and he rejects Yehuda's order. He does not want to impregnate Tamar in order to bear a child that will be called after his Bechor brother. We find out that God finds this displeasing as well, and he too is put to death. He too dies because he is displeasing to God. And at this point, Vayomer Yehuda l'Tamar kalato, Shvi almana beit avich ad yigdal shela bni, ki amar pen yamut gam hu ke'achav, v'telech Tamar v'teshev beit aviha. And Yehuda then says to his daughter-in-law, remain as a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. And in the back of his mind, he's thinking he too might die like his brothers. Yehuda looks for cause and effect. And what he comes to look at as the uniform thread between the two deaths of his sons is Tamar. And so consciously, or subconsciously, but it seems from the text consciously, he blames Tamar, and so he sends her away, and he sends her back to her father's house, which is essentially a type of death sentence for her, not death in the literal form, but a death to a life of wife and family and childbearing, and he does not see what God saw. In other words, Yehuda at this point has completely disengaged from his own family. He's gone on to build a family, and he seems somewhat disengaged from that family as well. When his oldest son dies, he takes action, but there doesn't seem to be any really premeditated thought as to the action. He gives Tamar to Onan without really thinking what he's asking Onan and Tamar to do. Again, perhaps because it's ancient Near Eastern law, but perhaps because he is so consumed with grief over the loss of his son that he wants to replace that son in any way he can. And when that doesn't work, he simply sends Tamar away so as not to really think more deeply about what message God may be sending him. And we as readers know God has been pretty clear about his message, meaning there's nothing subtle. The two men, the two sons, were wicked in the eyes of God, and as a result, they suffer this untimely death, and we know it, but Yehuda does not know it. V'telach Tamar v'teshev beit aviha, and at this point, Tamar went back to live in her father's house. She has been rejected as daughter-in-law, no opportunity to further her future as wife. She has been prevented from marrying Shelah, and as a result, she really is going to live this eternal widowhood. And so now let's see what's going to happen. And at this point, much time has passed. We're told much time has passed. And at this point, the daughter of Shua dies. We still don't know her name, the wife of Yehuda. And we find out he's been in touch all along with this Adulamite Chira. That's who he camped near at the very beginning of chapter 38. And he goes to shear the sheep with his friend. And Tamar was told, your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah for the sheep shearing. And now she does something astonishing. And she takes off her widow's garb, covers her face with a veil, wraps herself up, sits down at the entrance to Einayim, which also is the entrance of the eyes. Einayim is a kind of an open place at the crossroads, but also I can't ignore the beautiful literary allusion to seeing. And it's on the road to Timnata, and that's the way in which Judah will be passing. And she sees that Shelah has grown up and she has not been given to him as wife. And now we have a curious verse. Yehuda sees her and he thinks she's a prostitute because she has covered her face. And again, this often leads to a debate. Would a prostitute cover her face? I mean, you're going to be taking everything else off, so why keep your face covered? But the description here definitely is that she is identified as prostitute because her face is covered. It leads us back to the story of Rebecca, who veils herself when she sees Isaac for the first time, and clearly there the allusion is to modesty. So again, it's an interesting question. Is she covering her face out of modesty, even though she's going to uncover her body? We, of course, know it's Tamar and that she covers her face in order to mask her identity. There's a lot to do here with the veiling and the covering and what's going on. I could also suggest that perhaps Yehuda was supposed to be suspicious of a prostitute who covers her face, but he's so disengaged from any sort of reality or seeing reality, particularly in his family, that he assumes she's a prostitute, even though she's his daughter-in-law. And now begins a negotiation between Yehuda, whose wife is dead, who needs some sort of sexual outlet. And Tamar, of course, is gambling on this, either because she knows him and she knows this is something he's going to seek out, release. And perhaps he's done this even when he's married, or because she's gambled and she has nothing to lose. At this point, she's stuck in her father's house. And they begin to bargain. And she basically says to him, what are you going to give me? And basically he says, I'll send you a kid. And she says, that's not good enough. I need a pledge. What am I going to give you as a pledge? And here she kind of shows her card, so to speak, if he's only paying attention. Because what she says is, V'tomer chotamcha uftilecha umatcha asher biyadecha v'yitein la v'yavoy la v'tarhalo. She asks for his identity, his seal, his cord, the staff which he carries, and he just gives them to her. Which again is just a beautiful metaphor. Yehuda gives over his identity to Tamar without paying any attention to who she is, without thinking more deeply about what that means. And only in the aftermath is he going to realize how close he really has come to losing his identity. And so as soon as the act is done, after she becomes pregnant, and of course we can't ignore the fact that in Bereishit, in Genesis, God opens and closes wombs. And so he has immediately opened the womb of this woman. And so we recognize there's a righteousness. Of course, even righteous women have their wombs closed by God in the book of Bereishit. But here God has rewarded her, one would suggest, with immediate pregnancy. And she then goes and removes the clothing that she was wearing, puts back on her widow's garb, and waits to see what will happen. And now Yehuda, when he gets home, remembers that he made a pledge. He's not that out to lunch. He remembers. And he sends his friend the Adulamite. He doesn't go himself, though, which suggests that he's embarrassed. And that's going to be heightened in the next verse. We just said that the Adulamite cannot find her. Now verse 21. And so the Adulamite begins to ask, where's the prostitute, the Kadesha? And I love the fact that she's called a Kadesha in this verse. Earlier, she's called a Zona. A Zona would really, it suggests, be a lady of the night, a prostitute, someone who takes money for sex. A Kadesha is a cultic prostitute. So the Adulamite doesn't want to be seen as asking, well, where's the prostitute? So he calls her a cult prostitute, perhaps again to make it sound a little bit better for Yehuda, or perhaps because Yehuda told him that he stopped in to see a cult prostitute, someone who channels spirituality in the sexual act or some sort of religious religiosity in the sexual act, as opposed to a zona, which would just be a one-night stand. And he turns to Yehuda and he says, I couldn't find her. The townspeople have never heard of this Kadesha in this area, in the Petach Einayim, the crossroads of the eyes. And now Yehuda says, oh my God, let her keep them, lest we become a laughing stock. And of course, the plural, let her keep them. Presumably, he's referring to his identity, the seal, the cord, the staff, and hoping that she doesn't reveal his identity. Suddenly, his identity becomes very important to him. He's like, I sent her the kid and you did not find her. He recognizes that perhaps he stands to lose it all if she reveals his identity. Which begs the question, why? Meaning there would be nothing unseemly about a man visiting a prostitute at this time. But it suggests that Yehuda suddenly becomes concerned for his reputation. And perhaps as a man of standing in the community of Canaanites, this would be unseemly. Okay, moving on. And now that word zanta, which appeared in verse 15, right? This idea that not kdesha, not that she was a cult prostitute who got pregnant, but but a zonah who went a-whoring. And she's now being accused of this going a-whoring because, of course, v'gam hinei harad l'znunim, she became pregnant as a harlot. V'yomer Yehuda hotziu v'tisaref. And now the Yehuda we've come to know in this chapter, completely disengaged from any reality, from any consequence about his own behavior, essentially says, take her out and burn her. He doesn't ask why she's pregnant, how she got pregnant. Perhaps she was raped. He doesn't ask what his accountability is, having left her to rot in her father's home. He just take her out and burn her. Easiest solution. He can wash his hands of it completely. And so she's taken out to be burned. And she sends a message to her father-in-law. She has time. And essentially, she says, I am with child by the man to whom these belong. She does it subtly. She does not expose him. She continues to be very heroic, very clear in the direction she's going in. But also, I would suggest recognizing that as a woman, she's limited. So the rabbinic strata admire her very much for saving him from humiliation. I have to recognize that it might be less saving him from humiliation and more the recognition that as a powerful man, her fate lies in his hands. And even if she exposes him, it's possible it will end badly for her. But she does send him his identity back. She sends him the signs of his identity and a message. Vayakir Yehuda, and of course now Yehuda reemerges, he reengages completely. He recognizes, and I would suggest he doesn't just recognize the signs that she sent him. He recognizes himself, who he is, who he needs to be. Vayomar tzadka mimeni ki al ken lo netati al shela b'nei v'lo yosaf od l'data. And he says at this point, this is all my fault. I was supposed to give her to Shelah, my son, and I didn't do so. And he recognizes Tamar for who she is. He recognizes what the trajectory of his life had led to. And of course, this is decades. This is many years. His three sons have all grown up, including his youngest. So this is not a short story. And then the next scene is that she gives birth. She gives birth to twins. She has parrots and then Zarach. And from that birth comes the birth of David, who emerges from Paretz. And so the monarchy, essentially, the seeds of the monarchy are planted in the union between Yehuda and Tamar. As far as, you know, Tamar's character, she is doubly rewarded for taking action, for forcing Yehuda to regain his identity, and ultimately the seeds of the monarchy, David, who is also a very complicated character, emerges, and David too will engage in a journey of self-identity that leads to him recognizing the consequence of his actions and paying very dearly. I'm going to conclude here. I've already gone a little further than I should, and I'll say that this is a story that I think is one of the more positive stories. It's a story in which a woman uses the resources available to her as a woman, limited resources, it's true. Really, she's at the mercy of the men around her. But she does something astonishing. God rewards her. And ultimately, Yehuda then regains his sense of self and goes on to become a leader in his family and later on in his nation as a result of her taking the reins of the story, taking back the story, and re-entering the narrative. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you, Rabbanit Barash. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.